Our next case is 10-1601, Disciplinary Counsel versus Stafford. Mr. O'Neill.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices. May it please the court. My name is John O'Neill, and it's my privilege to represent Vincent Stafford, the respondent in this case. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are here, as you know, following a 5-count amended complaint, 22 days of trial, and numerous witnesses. The panel and the board recommended a dismissal of counts 3, 4, and 5, and we urge this court to agree with that and dismiss in their totality counts 3, 4, and 5. Likewise, in counts 1 and 2, the panel and board agreed that the over half of the counts in one, or allegations in counts 1 and 2, should be dismissed, and we likewise urge the court to agree with that finding. Finally, in counts 1 and 2, there were findings of violations of certain professional rules, which we urge this court to reverse that finding, dismissing all of those counts for the reasons set forth in the following and in our briefs. Initially, in the Radford case, that case initially came down to a discovery issue and some testimony that Mr. Stafford gave in front of Judge Flanagan as he was trying to defend his fees following the trial. There is no dispute that Mr. Stafford complied with his discovery obligations in that case. Initially, he provided interrogatory responses on behalf of his client, Diana Radford, to Herb Palkovitz on August 15th of 2006. Thereafter, he provided responsive documents to those discovery requests to Mr. Laubacher on August 30th of 2006. We know this because Diana Radford witnessed that exchange outside of Judge Flanagan's courtroom and testified to it during the divorce trial before there was ever an issue about outstanding discovery or Mr. Stafford's compliance with discovery. Moreover, Honorable Judge Flanagan testified that he recalls at that pretrial on October 30th that Mr. Stafford told Mr. Laubacher that he had documents that he would exchange with him in the hallway. He also
those documents labeled or stated that they were the discovery?
There was no bait stamps on those documents. No, it was hand-delivered to him in a white envelope.
But nobody saw what was in that envelope.
Diana Radford did not see what was in that envelope, but what we do know is Diana Radford testified that during the hearing in July of 2007, the documents that she had provided to Mr. Stafford before that, she saw her client, Bruce Radford, outlining and underlining on those documents. So we know Mr. Laubacher got those documents because Diana Radford saw them being reviewed by Bruce Radford some months later while they were at another hearing. So there's certainly evidence to the fact that, one, Mr. Stafford testified he saw it, two, Diana Radford had previously recently given him those documents, and three, she saw those exact same documents in Bruce Radford's hands some months later following or during a hearing.
Counsel, one of the problems I have in reading this, you read your brief and it's all your assertions that these things should be dismissed and because this fact and that fact, then you read disciplinary counsel and they think a lot of the counts that were dismissed should be reinstated, but much of it comes down to credibility. And again, as you read the findings, they all say, I believe this, I didn't believe this, I didn't know who to believe, so we were dismissing this. So much of it's credibility. And how do we determine who to believe based on a cold record when you had three people who appeared to make very careful about going through the evidence and very careful about assessing credibility? It's obvious that they took their job very seriously. How do we duplicate that at an appellate level when 90% of the case seems to be credibility?
Well, that's a good question, and I would say to you, on credibility matters, I think the panel got it right. When it comes down to who was credible and who testified to what, I don't think there's any dispute that they are not saying that, we're not saying that there was an issue with credibility that the panel or board members got wrong. What we're saying is, when you look at the actual violations, it's not a credibility matter. The simple fact is that discovery was complied with, it was provided with in a timely manner, And if you want to get into this dispute, they really come down to a couple of lines or pages in that hearing when Mr. Stafford was trying to get his fees. Mr. Stafford the entire time was saying to Judge Flanagan, to Mr. Kubin, go get Herb Palkovitz. He'll tell you I gave you him the interrogatories. Go get Laubacher. Bring him in here. He'll tell you he got the documents. So disciplinary counsel wants to try to...
Well, why didn't he bring them in?
He didn't need to. There was no... Why would Mr. Stafford need to bring somebody else in to establish what he had already said when there was no contradicting evidence?
Because they don't believe him, because they don't believe him in about 20 other counts.
I'm talking about in the underlying trial with Judge Flanagan. Herb Palkovitz was still alive. There was no one disputing what Mr. Stafford was saying. Mr. Kubin couldn't dispute it and didn't dispute it. Mr. Krawinski didn't dispute it and couldn't dispute it. Mr. Stafford even said, take the stand, Mr. Kubin, Mr. Krawinski. Bring anybody else in you want. They didn't do that. There was no reason for Mr. Stafford to have to go bring other witnesses in to support what he was saying. He never thought Mr. Palkovitz was going to be to die. He never not thought that this would even be a disciplinary matter. He wasn't thinking that far ahead. He was just trying to put testimony on to support his fees.
Since you bring the Radford matter forward, in the objections to the board's findings, the statements made at page 29, the reality is respondent never provided formal responses to the request for production of documents served by Bruce Radford's lawyers. You dispute that.
Do I dispute that?
Yes.
I think
what Justice Stratton's talking about. One party looks at it and says there was never a response. You say there was a response.
I think the record is clear that, or the testimony was clear, that the actual formal typed up responses to the request for production of documents, there was no record of that ever being turned over. The actual documents were turned over. The formal interrogatory discovery responses were turned over. Absolutely.
It seems that the common thread through all of the cases is sort of a disrespect for opposing counsel and a failure to comply promptly with discovery. Do you see that thread?
I don't see that. In fact, what I see is, in the Radford matter, to take a step back, it is a contested divorce
matter.
Sort
of a he said, she said situation. I understand that. But I'm looking more globally at the entire file.
At all five counts. Yes, Justice. What I would say to that is, let's look at where we are. We are in domestic relations court in Cuyahoga County, where there are some big dollars at stake, where Mr. Stafford has made it his living to represent women who literally have been thrown to the curb by wealthy businessmen who decided that they want to move on with the old model and get a new model. And he is there fighting for those people's rights. And so that is going to be contested because those individuals have never heard no. They've never been called on the carpet, and someone needs to do that.
But we require civility and adherence to our rules in discovery. And it seems like in all of these instances, it's just a failure to show courtesy or respect and to comply with the discovery request.
Well, I would say in Radford, I think the evidence is that he did comply.
Okay.
In Janicek, that was not a discovery issue whatsoever. In Tellerico, there was never a discovery issue. In fact, in Tellerico, it was the exact opposite. Lou Tellerico and his lawyers, Sarah Gabonet and Avery Jaffe, they refused to give discovery. They refused to follow any court orders whatsoever, which forced Mr. Stafford, in order to protect Elaine Tellerico, to file numerous motions to show cause so her bills would get paid, so her lights would not be turned off like they were on her birthday, so her horses would be taken care of. That was Mr. Stafford doing what was required in order to protect his client's rights. He complied with discovery. Lou Tellerico and his lawyers did not. Kostya was not a discovery issue as well. So I don't think this is an overriding discovery issue, and Murky v. Housel was not necessarily a discovery issue. That was a difference in opinion as to what the appeal was all about and what documents were in existence at the time.
Mr. Neal, though, The attitude that Justice O'Donnell describes was also apparent in the disciplinary proceeding. The record talks about disrespect to disciplinary counsel and a pervasive attitude of almost contempt for the proceeding. So it isn't just confined to the DR arena in Cuyahoga County.
Well, and I would say, Justice, and that's a good question, and I'm glad you brought that up. To understand what Mr. Stafford had been through from 2006 up until today has been a constant avalanche of allegations from opposing counsels, from opposing litigants, not from his own clients. He had investigations, the allegation is, and I think the evidence is, that the investigation was such that independent witnesses that Mr. Stafford brought forth for disciplinary counsel to investigate were ignored. They weren't even talked to before the complaint was filed. Disciplinary counsel went to Cuyahoga County Domestic Relations Court, locked themselves in a room, and went through every single one of his files and his brother's files. So he was under intense scrutiny, the type of scrutiny I dare say nobody has ever been under, certainly not in Cuyahoga County. And yes, there was some emotion to that, and there were times when, based on frustration, where he wasn't able to be heard, where independent witnesses weren't looked into. His own clients were being contacted to see if they were going to have, wanted to make a complaint against him. And what we have here, and I see I'm running out of time, but what we have here is we don't have his own clients making complaints against
him. But counsel, doesn't that, I don't think there's any dispute that Mr. Stafford is interested in zealously representing his clients. The question here is when does that cross over into the problem of hurting the administration of justice, the respect to other officers of the court, the idea that you may be prolonging litigation excessively, and getting into areas where it's the opponents and the opponents' attorneys that are the ones complaining, not the clients.
Well, Judge Lansgren, I would just point out to you in the Radford matter specifically, if you want to start there, Judge Flanagan made a finding and testified under oath that there was not one delay based upon Mr. Stafford or Diana Radford. All the delays were based on Bruce Radford or his lawyers. Likewise, there's not one document that anybody could point to that that was asked for and Mr. Stafford did not turn over. So this discovery issue and compliance with discovery, the facts don't support it. Likewise, in all the other claims, yes, there was a delay in the appeal on Murky v. Housel, but that was an interlocutory appeal based upon attorney-client privilege, attorney work product, and spousal privilege, of which I think we all would agree, especially when your client is not one to waive it like Dr. Murky was not, you need to protect it, and that's what he did.
Counsel, what would you attribute then the complaints and the significance or the beginnings of this entire disciplinary action? Is it a conspiracy against your client? Is it a collaborative effort by those that would bring him down? What is your allegation here?
Well, I think the evidence is such, and Mr. Stafford has testified to it, and other people have testified to it, that this all occurred a few weeks following the legal malpractice case that Mr. Stafford prosecuted on behalf of Dr. Murky against Robert Housel, where Mr. Housel said he was going to use his influence in order to try to get Stafford. And as a board member at the time, and all heck broke loose after that, we've got members of his country club, Janicek and Tellerico, all of a sudden coming out and making these allegations following that incident. We have, Radford is independent, he's not related to any of those, but certainly we have that connection between some of the complainants. Now, is it a grand conspiracy? You know, I don't know, but the facts are what the facts are, and this all occurred a few weeks after the verdict against Housel, and then Bob Housel had his lawyers, Monica Sansaloni, send file materials to Jonathan Marshall, and Mr. Stafford has been investigated since that time, and he's been pursued up until now. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time, unless there's any other questions.
Ms. Brown.
Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, I'm Lori Brown, Chief Assistant Disciplinary Counsel on behalf of Relator Disciplinary Counsel. I would like to reserve approximately 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. relator's position in this matter is that the board's findings as to count one and count two are entirely correct. Our position is that their findings as to the recommended sanction, the aggravating factors, the lack of mitigation are also correct. Relator's position is that there are additional violations in count one and in count two that can be found by this court based on a thorough analysis of the record. With regard to the violations found in count one, the board found that Mr. Stafford's testimony at the during the Radford trial in October of 2007 was, according to the board, filled with purposeful obfuscations. He erected a smokescreen, he derailed the search for the truth, and he played hide the ball. If you work backward from those findings, you will agree with the board and with relator that Mr. Stafford violated both the Code of Professional Responsibility and the Rules for Professional Conduct in count one. Mr. O'Neill would like to assert that there is no dispute with regard to whether Vincent Stafford turned discovery over to Bruce Radford's counsel in count one. Relator agrees that there is no dispute. However, relator's position is that, in fact, discovery was not turned over by Vincent Stafford. The evidence in the record that establishes that is, number one, Eric Laubacher filed a motion to compel on November 17, 2006, which is after the date referred to by Mr. O'Neill that Mr. Stafford supposedly handed an envelope to Mr. Laubacher. Eric Laubacher testified, and there is an affidavit in the record that was filed with the motion to compel, that he would not have filed the motion to compel if he had received discovery before that date. Judge Flanagan, in fact, granted that motion to compel. What happened after that is that Mr. Laubacher wrote a letter to Judge Flanagan and said, "I still don't have my discovery." Mr. Stafford then called Mr. Laubacher and assured him discovery would be forthcoming. That happened in December of 2006, well after the time that Vincent Stafford claims to have given discovery to Bruce Radford's counsel. Let's talk for just a moment about the interrogatories that Mr. Stafford supposedly handed to Herb Palkovitz at some point in the Cuyahoga County Court of Domestic Relations. When you look at those interrogatories, it's Relator's Exhibit 31, you will find that they are handwritten, incomplete, unverified, and incorrect. Those interrogatories were not handed to Herb Palkovitz, and the evidence on that is clear. Sherry Lanzalotta, Herb Palkovitz's paralegal, testified that she never saw those interrogatories. Taking it one step farther, if in fact Vincent Stafford had handed interrogatories to Herb Palkovitz, common sense, common courtesy, and reason dictates that when Eric Laubacher asked interrogatories, when Russ Kubin filed a motion for sanction because he didn't have discovery, common sense and common courtesy dictates that Vincent Stafford says, "I gave those to Herb Palkovitz way back in August of 2006, or here's another copy of them, the handwritten, unverified interrogatories. But the reality is, and the evidence is clear, that Russ Kubin never saw those interrogatories until October of 2007, when Diana Radford testified that, gosh, she had in fact completed interrogatories. So despite Mr. O'Neill's reference to this court that there is no dispute about discovery, there was a dispute, and there is a dispute in the sense that Relator believes there was no discovery given. Respondent's position is that he proved he did give discovery. You have to evaluate both sides. The board, however, found that discovery was not, that his testimony at the Radford trial was filled with, as I said, purposeful obfuscations, and that that testimony violated DR 1102, 8.4C and 8.4D and 8.4H, as well as Rule 3.4. Relator encourages you to go one step farther and find that that testimony also violates 8.4C. On its face, the testimony is misleading and deceitful. Regardless of whether this court goes so far as to find that Mr. Stafford lied about whether he gave discovery to Herb Palkovitz, this court can still find, and Relator believes, in fact, the board did find, a violation of 8.4C.
Counsel?
Yes.
There's been some allegations or suggestions that this is some sort of witch hunt that is related to Mr. Housel and his being a member of the disciplinary board. That's a pretty serious allegation. Could you address your viewpoint of that allegation?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Mr. O'Neill offered to this court that there was evidence that Relator's counsel spent a day locked in a room at the Cuyahoga County Court going through every file of Mr. Stafford, both Mr. Stafford, Joseph Stafford, and Vincent Stafford. There is no evidence of that. This court is well aware of the disciplinary counsel's role. I could recite my job description, but I don't think I need to do that for this court. Part of what we do is evaluate files. That is part and parcel of prosecuting a case, of investigating a case. There is nothing nefarious about a disciplinary counsel being in the Cuyahoga County Courthouse. Likewise, there is no evidence, Your Honor, and I will testify that, or I will tell you that Murky versus Housel, by its very nature, involved testimony regarding Robert Housel. There is testimony from his counsel that she, at his request, sent matters to Jonathan Marshall at the Board of Commissioners. That was the testimony. There was no, Mr. Marshall wasn't called to testify. There is no evidence as to what happened to that material. There is nothing nefarious about that either. The grievance in Murky versus Housel was filed by Mr. Housel's counsel, Alan Petroff and Monica Santoloni. The other matters that Mr. O'Neill infers were instigated, if you will, by Mr. Housel, there was no evidence of that other than Mr. Stafford's belief that because Mr. Janicek played golf with Mr. Housel at some point in Florida, that somehow he was put up to filing a grievance by Mr. Housel. There was no evidence to that, and the testimony from Mr. Janicek is, in fact, opposite that. Mr. Tellerico, who testified in count four, Lou Tellerico, doesn't even know Bob Housel. So the idea that there is some, I would like to call it the Housel conspiracy behind all of this, there is no evidence to support that, Your Honor. Mr. Housel did not testify. Mr. Housel is no longer on the board. I'd like to talk for a moment about sanction, and then I will reserve the remainder of my time. The board found in this case that there were a number of aggravating factors. I'd like to just cite this court to a few of them. There were multiple offenses as part of a pattern of obstructing discovery. This court has taken up the obstruction of discovery in the Wallace case, in the Marsick case, and in the Finneran case. That in and of itself calls for an actual suspension. The board found a selfish motive on the part of Vincent Stafford, and I refer this court to the fact that in neither of the two cases, Murky versus Housel or the Radford case, did Mr. Stafford's clients gain any advantage whatsoever by his refusal to turn over discovery, by his refusal to tell opposing counsel exactly what was going on with the evidence that he had or did not have. Mr. Stafford has been previously disciplined, as noted by the board in the year 2000. There is a commonality between the Radford case and the Housel case when this court evaluates it closely. It is a reluctance on the part of Mr. Stafford to be forthcoming and honest with opposing parties and opposing counsels.
To what end would Mr. Stafford do that? I think the allegations is coming through is he's doing this to increase his fees, that being obstreperous and uncooperative allows for additional hearings, additional motions, additional responses, an increase in fees. Is that what the allegations are here?
In fact, in count two, the Murky versus Housel count, the allegation is that Mr. Stafford did what he did, engaged in the misconduct that the board found in order to harass Robert Housel. And there is some evidence of that in the record. And quite frankly, if this is a case, Murky versus Housel, which in fact was done on a handshake, as Mr. Stafford indicated, the final word apparently, and contrary to the board said that there was evidence that Dr. Murky had paid Stafford's fees. I don't believe there is evidence of that. So we don't know whether that was to increase fees. But there could be no other reason, Your Honor, that you could fathom that you would go from 2004 through 2005 to 2006 and argue that certain material and documents were privileged when in fact they did not exist. The argument that documents are privileged is an argument that they exist. In this case, as it turns out and has now been admitted, those documents did not, they were not created until May 27th of 2006. So from August of 2004, all the way through May of 2006, there was an argument that they were privileged when they did not exist. Whether it's to increase fees, whether it's to harass the other party, we believe the evidence shows, particularly in Murky versus Housel, that it was to harass the other party. In Radford, the testimony that is Exhibit 30, which is the transcript of the October 9th, 2007 hearing, there can be no other reason for it other than the result, which was it is prejudicial to the administration of justice and it adversely reflects on his practice of law. We would be speculating as to why he gave such testimony. I would like to touch, before I stop, for just one moment on an important issue with regard to Murky versus Housel, and that is whether the respondent ratified the pleadings that were signed by his associate, Gregory Moore. Ratified is the board's word, and it may or may not be an apt word in this circumstance. The respondent, Vincent Stafford, was counsel of record for Dr. Murky. At all times, he was lead counsel in Murky versus Housel. Mr. Stafford, in his own words, quarterbacked the direction of Murky versus Housel. When you look at Exhibit 65, which is the fee bills that were ultimately created by Stafford and Stafford, you will find that he was intimately involved. Mr. Stafford is responsible for every violation charged in count two, which is Murky versus Housel. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, you reserve 56 seconds, but take a minute.
Thank you. Fought hard, fought fair. That was the term that Mr. Kubin used following the Radford v. Radford matter. There was no discovery dispute. He was correct. It was fought hard and it was fought fair. That's how Radford went down from the lead trial lawyer. Now, he didn't realize at the time that nobody had asked for separate property. All the other form discovery that had been sent out had never been asked for. And so when his client testified on the stand, frankly not credibly, about separate property going back to the 80s on that Schwab account that was Diana Radford's, it was never even an issue in the case until he brought that up, and that's when the documents had to go get discovered. And that's why Mr. Kubin was asking about these discovery requests. And once they went over them, line by line, and as he testified to, excruciatingly detail, they realize no one ever asked for separate property.
And thank you.
I asked for an outright dismissal on all the claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brown, you reserved a little under 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Responding to Mr. O'Neill's statement that it was fought hard but fought fair. Fair would have been, fair and ethical would have been in January of 2007 when Russ Kubin filed a motion for sanctions based upon Mr. Stafford's failure to comply with the court's order granting Mr. Laubacher's motion to compel. Fair would have been to communicate with Mr. Kubin and to explain to Mr. Kubin in January of 2007 that in fact, if it happened, he gave interrogatories to Herb Palkovitz months before. Or, here's a list of the documents I gave to Eric Laubacher. None of that happened in the Radford case. Documents were not given. Communication was not had. I'd like to talk just for a moment, refer to the argument about separate property. As Relator has argued in its answer, separate property is a smokescreen, just like much of Mr. Stafford's testimony in Exhibit 30. There was no reference to separate property in the board's report, and I encourage this court to ignore the respondent's effort to bring it before the court today. I'd like to talk briefly about the cases that were recently cited by Relator, the Pullins case. That case is cited for the proposition that this court, and only this court, can decide whether the respondent committed violations of the rules. It is irrelevant whether there were motions for sanctions filed and denied. This court is the court that can decide whether the conduct was unethical. The Ricketts case is cited for the proposition that Mr. Stafford is not protected from discipline by this court based on the Rust case. The respondent's argument that he has a claim to this court based on Rust is misplaced. In order to have a valid legal argument, you must have a valid factual argument. The respondent was making arguments in Murky versus Housel that they may have been legally supportable. He did not have the facts to even make the arguments.
Your argument is largely factual, Ms. Brown, but you are urging that we impose a more severe discipline on the respondent, Mr. Stafford.
We are, Your Honor.
What is your strongest reason why we should increase the penalty from what the board found?
The board recommended 18 months with 12 months stayed.
Yes.
They also recommended that a monitor be appointed. I think Mr. O'Neill and I have agreed on something, and that is that a monitor is not appropriate in this case. The board went all the way to 18 months. Relator argues for an actual suspension matching that, in other words, an actual 18-month suspension. I believe that regardless of whether this court finds additional violations, as Relator has argued in his objections, an 18-month actual suspension is appropriate based on the aggravating factors cited by the board. That includes one of the final lines, which is that the respondent cannot be allowed to continue toying with the administration of justice. And Relator believes that based on that and the aggravating factors and the violations, an actual 18-month suspension is appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be advised. Thank you.